KALW.
With vaccines, you have several goals, right? The first thing you want to know is if a vaccine works.
But after they've been proven effective, the research continues.
So now our job is to find out for how long.
Today, we'll hear from a Bay Area nurse who's working on a local COVID-19 vaccine trial. Then health departments are reaching out to pastors to help with vaccine outreach.
But with this disease, with this virus, it's so deadly and it's so devastating to my community and communities of color that I just have to speak loudly against the hesitancy.
And we take you to an art studio where a variety of classes are carrying on through the pandemic.
It's better for me to be online because I've had a lot of health issues going on.
That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. In our ongoing series, At Work, we're talking to folks in the Bay Area about what they do and how it's changed.
I have a lot of pride in my work.
How do you do it?
Sprays, masks, gloves.
I'm with the Swamp Team.
Hi, my friends, and how are you?
It's nice now with technology.
Pandora's box has been opened.
It's a beautiful way to make your living, but it's more work than I ever imagined.
On February 1st, the country marked a significant milestone. The number of people in the U.S. who've gotten at least one shot of a COVID vaccine surpassed the total number of Americans who've been infected with the virus. While the rollout has been far from smooth, the fact that we have several effective vaccines is something to be grateful for. But what does it take to get to the point that a vaccine is ready to be used? Today, in this installment of At Work, we find out. KALW's Scott Carroll introduces us to a local nurse who's been working on the clinical trials of a COVID vaccine.
Elba Avila's office is on the ground floor of the former Masonic Temple near the corner of Market and Van Ness, a few blocks from San Francisco's City Hall. It's a majestic building with an ornate doorway and statues and columns around the outside. But inside, her office is much more like an everyday clinic. Elba's a nurse on a COVID vaccine clinical trial. During COVID, while most of us have been hunkering down, Elba has been working hard to help get us a vaccine.
I've been working 6 days a week for the past, couple months. Sometimes we go in at 7 a.m. and we don't come out until 7 p.m.
I first spoke with her on a Sunday in November. Weekends would normally be a time for her to be with family. But COVID has changed things.
I haven't seen my family in like 2 months because both of my parents are about 78 years old and my dad has chronic kidney disease.
Elba's family moved to the Bay Area from Mexico when she was 15. Since then, large weekend gatherings had been the norm.
I have a really large family. There's 8 of us. So even just by getting together with my immediate family is like already a party, like way beyond the CDC guidelines.
The research unit that Elba works in is part of a San Francisco health program called Bridge HIV that normally studies things like pills and vaccines to prevent HIV infections. When the COVID pandemic hit, their expertise allowed them to quickly take on COVID vaccine trials. That's when Elba was hired. Both personally and professionally, the job has been a great fit.
As a queer woman of color, one of my goals career-wise was actually working in a place that worked with a very diverse community. So for me, being able to work in a clinic that is super queer-friendly, that really embraces people of color, people with different identities, was kind of my dream job.
So what exactly is her job? Elba explains that testing a vaccine once it has reached human trials is a long and involved process. And as a clinician, she works directly with the participants throughout.
With vaccines, you have several goals, right? The first thing you want to know is if a vaccine works.
In other words, does it prevent someone from getting COVID? Early data indicates that their vaccine does.
So now our job is to find out for how long. How long are those antibodies going to protect you?
And will people need additional injections in the months and years ahead to stay protected? The vaccine they are studying is made by AstraZeneca and Oxford University. You may have heard about the vaccine in the news for some unfortunate reasons.
Development questions mounting over AstraZeneca and Oxford's vaccine candidates after they acknowledged a manufacturing error that affected trial results.
But the vaccine has been making news for some very good reasons as well. Unlike the first two vaccines approved for use in the United States, this one doesn't need to be frozen. That makes it a lot easier and cheaper to distribute and store.
So being able to reach communities that are very rural or countries that don't have the ability to keep vaccines that are very, very low temperature will give us the ability to reach a greater audience.
When the study launched, the response from the community was tremendous. Hundreds of potential volunteers from around the Bay Area stepped forward.
There's people who work in restaurants, there's lawyers, there's scientists, there's nurses, doctors, and everyone has been so nice.
The initial safety trials were conducted in the UK. This is a much larger trial with 30,000 volunteers. It's taking place in 44 states across the US with additional sites in Colombia, Peru, Chile, and Argentina. Elba's San Francisco site has been enrolling 250 of these participants.
This is probably the biggest amount of recruits in a short amount of time that we have done.
Screening people into the study is done in several steps.
That starts with an info session about what you can expect, the type of commitment, what are our goals in the trial, and some of the risks that might, you know, that might come with joining the trial, and just have them an opportunity to ask questions. So a lot of my job is just counseling. Is this the right thing for you?
And if somebody wants to move forward, then Elba and other clinicians dig into their medical history.
Safety is our number one concern, so we want to make sure that joining this trial is not going to hinder you in any way. So if you have any uncontrolled or severe chronic diseases, we have to make sure that we're able to keep that in mind.
If there are no red flags in their medical history, then prospective participants are invited into the clinic for an in-person medical exam.
And if everything goes well, we'll order the injection, so either the placebo or the vaccine.
This is a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study, the gold standard in trial design. Neither the researchers nor the participants know who's getting the actual vaccine. This means the folks running the study can't knowingly or accidentally influence the results.
And then we give them the injection, and then we follow up for the next 2 years. So we'll see them again in 29 days, and then 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, 1 year, 2 year.
Elba is proud of the work she's doing and has been heartened by all of the Bay Area residents who have volunteered to take part.
It's been a really great pleasure to be able to help, you know, drive this greater cause of creating a vaccine, but also be able to meet so many people who are willing to donate their time and, you know, their body for the greater benefit of society, for you and I, for so many other people, and maybe generations to come. We don't know.
And in the short term, the hope is that this easier-to-store vaccine will make its way to harder-to-reach communities across the globe. In Berkeley, I'm Scott Carroll for CrossCurrents.
Thanks, Scott. If you'd like to find out more about the work that Elba is involved in, or if you want to be a volunteer in a local clinical trial to prevent COVID, HIV, and other infectious diseases, we've got a link. Go to klw.org. And tune in tomorrow at 5 for the next story in our At Work series.
We would show up at 7:30 in the morning at some of these places like Cow Palace, and there would be 200 people there already.
We'll meet Ellen Garcia, who helps get groceries to people in need, tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. It's one thing to have a vaccine available, but another to actually get people to take it. Bay Area health departments have been reaching out to leaders in Black communities to talk to them about the COVID vaccine. These communities are disproportionately vulnerable, but they're also the ones with most hesitancy to trust the vaccine. And that's where people like this come in.
Good morning. God bless you. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, the St. Stephen.
That's David Isom. He's pastor at the St. Stephen's CME Church in Fairfield. He's working with the county to provide his congregation with information about the vaccine. I talked to Pastor Isom about the role of clergy in creating vaccine awareness. I asked him first what the challenges are in his community.
I was scrolling online not too long ago, and I saw a prominent member of an African-American community, and he was just really, really, really slamming the vaccine, creating antitrust issues between cultures. I was shocked because this person has a huge, huge following. I'm talking millions. I'm not talking about a pastor. I'm talking about someone who has a following of a religious organization, a community. And it was horrifying to me to hear this person that has so many African-Americans that listen to him, that follow him, to just denounce the vaccine, say, I'm not going to let anyone put a needle in my arm. The whole thing really just disturbed me. And I started sharing that with friends of mine and people in ministry saying, hey, this is what we're up against. If you're wondering where people are getting the hesitancy from and why people in our community are hesitant about this, here's huge reasoning.
And so I'm wondering, have you heard this kind of thing from people, you know, around you in your congregation? What kind of things are people saying in terms of this vaccine?
It's mixed. I've got some of my members. So right now my church is an older congregation. We're African-American, primary African-American, older congregation. I would say my average membership age would be 60. I would say that would be an average. And so some of my seniors are saying, you know, they're not really interested in getting it. And I've got some of my seniors that are saying they're going to get it. So it's really, right now for me, it's not 50-50. I think I would say 80-20, 80 that are going to get it and 20 are saying they're not sure yet. One thing that I'm doing is saying the minute that I can get it, I'm going to get it. My wife works in the healthcare profession, and she has gotten her first of two doses. And we're promoting that, like letting people know that our family is supportive of the vaccine. As a matter of fact, my better half has already gotten, again, the initial dosage.
Mm. So that's your message. What do you think, you know, there's a lot of analysis about where Black hesitancy is coming from. And a lot of people are talking about, well, you know, there's a mistrust of systems, there's a history of abuse of Black bodies and all of these things. Where do you think it comes from, this hesitancy?
Pre-existing conditions are there a lot of times. And the reason that there are a lot of pre-existing conditions in African-American communities and communities of color is because of all of the health inequalities and inequities that we've been dealing with for decades and decades and decades. I would even say centuries. Of health inequalities. And when you have that, then the trust has already been infringed upon because we're not able to get the type of care that we need. We've got these issues that are not being addressed because of the inequality. And now you're saying, okay, I really need you to step up to the plate because we've got something for you. Again, I see where the hesitancy is. I see why the hesitancy is there, but with this disease, with this virus, it's so deadly and it's so devastating to my community and communities of color that I just have to speak loudly against the hesitancy.
What messaging do you think really works as a pastor?
You know, a lot of people trust pastors. You know, our members, I sometimes say, they should know all the time in terms of what we tell them, because a lot of times pastors don't know what they're talking about on some things, but we're trusted to know. And so I think that the best thing that pastors can do in their faith communities is have connections, be aware of the resources and activities in their communities so they can send that way. I don't have to know everything about the vaccine, but I know who does, right? I know that Kedra McNeil, who is the assistant physician in chief for culturally responsive care and inclusion at Kaiser, right? An African-American doctor here in my community that's born and raised in Fairfield. I say, call her, reach out to her. She knows what she's talking about because she is a doctor, but she's an African-American physician. I'm your pastor. Trust that I'm sending you to the right person.
Did you take this upon yourself because you know you have influence? Is there a religious or faith reason you did this? Or can you shed light on that?
Well, you know, people go into ministry for various reasons. I hope they're all called to be a benefit to the people of God. In my calling, I believe that community is huge. I believe that we should take care of one another. I think that's what we've been called to do as Christians. And the more resources that we have, I think that the role of a pastor is a resource person. I read the Bible, I write a message, and I give that information to people. So I'm a resource concerning the Holy Bible, the Word of God. I'm a resource to how to live. I can, you know, tell you that and work the scriptures in that way. In the same way, since I don't know anything about a roof, when someone comes to me and says, "Pastor, I need to know about this on my roof," I say, "I don't have any idea what you're talking about, but here's a number with a roofing company." So I think that we need to be able to give the information to our communities that we don't have, but that is accurate and that is out there.
Pastor, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
You can hear more about the COVID vaccine and Black communities in the latest episode of The Stoop podcast, hosted by me and Leela Day. We'll have a link at klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. The pandemic has upset nearly every facet of life as we know it. But for people with developmental disabilities, the closures and stay-at-home orders pose unique challenges. For this group of people that relies on daily routines and in-person day programs to feel socially connected and fulfilled, how do you create that same feeling of community and connectivity miles apart? Reporter Isabella Bloom went to an art studio for adults with developmental disabilities in Richmond and checked in on how they've adapted to meet their artists' needs.
I'm meeting up with an art studio manager to see his artist's latest exhibit.
Yeah, sure. We're on 120th at the Carpath. Common Sound.
Liam Golden would normally be showing me this display in an indoor gallery. But because of COVID, the art hangs on a display panel in the window for a socially distanced exhibition.
We're on 23rd Street, right in the heart of Richmond, not too far from City Hall. It's a row of mostly like auto body and car repair and tire shops. In fact, our building used to be car repair.
And it's quite a display. One piece that's up is a letterpress print by Shayna Harper that says,
"I'm not weird, I am limited edition."
Love that.
Yeah.
Golden manages the studio at Nurturing Independence Through Artistic Development, or NIAD. It's for artists with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Artists from NIAD have gained lots of recognition, with showings from SF MoMA to the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York City. Golden lets me inside and shows me around the studio.
So it's, you just put your name, the date.
Before the pandemic, the studio would be buzzing with 55 artists and staff creating art. But now...
it's eerie at the moment because it's so silent. It typically is very noisy.
NIAD has two sister organizations, Creative Growth in Oakland and Creativity Explored in San Francisco. Together, they serve almost 350 artists with developmental disabilities. When Governor Newsom announced a statewide shelter in place in March, they all were forced to temporarily shut down their physical studios. The disruption was hard for almost everyone, but it hits the developmentally disabled community especially hard.
I think at first we really wondered, how are we gonna maintain these sort of thriving conversations?
Amanda Eicher is the executive director of NIAD. She says the staff felt a sense of urgency to get the artists plugged in as quickly as possible. So they switched to a virtual studio.
It's eerie for about
I miss all my friends at NIAID.
Rebecca Jansen's been at NIAID for about 5 years. She's grateful for the virtual classes.
It's better for me to be online because I've had a lot of health issues going on. And so it's easier for me to be online right now because otherwise I'd be having to miss so many days of NIAID.
Jansen's in a class led by Liam Golden, who found a way to make a very pandemic-appropriate art class with the help of the U.S. Postal Service. The mail art class starts with staff mailing out art supplies and envelopes. Then, on Zoom, Golden turns on some jazz, and artists create art that can fit into envelopes and be sent on. But sometimes transitioning certain existing classes online, like NIAID's movement class, can be awkward.
You're too embarrassed to sit there and be doing exercise on the computer. We would like raise our hands or move our feet or, you know, just like do the butterfly where you put your hands behind you and make a butterfly and they twirl around, things like that.
Deshauna Kennard has been at NIAID for a little over a year and likes the online classes for a reason most people can relate to.
I can be home and relax. I ain't got to get dressed.
NIAID offers 6 hours of programming over Zoom each day. In addition to their usual classes, drawing, textile, sculpting, and ceramics, NIAID has found a way to continue offering cooking classes, bingo, self-advocacy, and even dance parties. Staff also drive supplies out to the artists every other Thursday, with deliveries up to Rodeo in northern Contra Costa County and as far south as Fremont. But Amanda Eicher says there are still challenges.
One of the big challenges is that the best feedback for most artists, but especially for ours, comes from that in-person engagement with other people around your work. And it has been really important to acknowledge that there's no substitute for that feeling.
But artists like Deshauna Kennard are aware of the dangers of the pandemic and are willing to patiently wait until things are safe again.
But I do miss going to NIAID too, but I'd rather just be safe until the coronavirus is over.
She's excited to go back to the in-person studio once it opens, but wants to continue taking online classes as well.
I think I want to do both because I like going to NIAID in person to see all my friends, and the staffs there are nice, and the field trips, and then online I get to sit here and relax and it's still do the classes.
And NIAID's listening to its artists. When the pandemic is over, they'll resume on-site classes and continue running a virtual program for artists who want to do both. In Richmond, I'm Isabella Bloom for Cross Currents.
Isabella Bloom is a student at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. If you or someone you know is an aspiring audio journalist, KELW is now accepting applications for our summer news internship. Go to klw.org/summer to learn more, and the deadline is March 8th. Before we leave you, it's about that time to listen to some new music from a local artist. San Francisco band Bill Meyer and the Grand Nationals. Their album New Old Stock came out in January.
Today's Cross Currents team includes Carla Estevez, Ren Farrell, Lisa Morehouse, Sonia Narung, Marissa Ortega Welch, and Victor Tense. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. Production manager is Shirin Hadil. Managing editor is David Boyer. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.